reaching out for help that morning, I was very lucky that my best friend answered the phone call. But that, I guess, started me on a path to actually being able to ask for help and being able to speak about what I was going through. And then in turn, the more I spoke about it, obviously you start to become more comfortable. But the other thing that I started to see was the help that was available.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Throughout the last year and a half, there have been many episodes of Deep in the Weeds openly discussing the issues with mental health in the hospitality sector and, at least traditionally, its unwillingness to acknowledge them. And although in recent years the paradigm has shifted, this recent upheaval in our lives has brought it to the fore. There are some that have been at the forefront of change to deliver support, remove the stigma of mental health, and provide a place for people to share their issues. Mal Mears is the founder of Food for Thought Fundraising Initiative and creator of Food Plus Wine Pop-Up. Mal, how are you going?
I'm good, thanks, mate. How are you?
I'm good. You've worked in some pretty incredible restaurants over your career so far, but you've done a full circle already and you're back sort of in the area you grew up.
Yeah, I mean, I've been pretty fortunate to learn my craft at quite a number of great cities and number of great restaurants. But it's definitely time to finally come home and see what Brisbane's doing.
On that journey, you had all sorts of issues and created initiatives for change, which I'd love to dive into at some stage, but where did your interest in food begin?
It was really just out of luck. I sort of fell into it. I wanted to finish high school, and Dad thought it would be good to have a vet in the family because he was training greyhounds all throughout my childhood. good business decision. But that sort of went by the wayside when I passed out a couple of times in the operating theatre and then realised it for me. I guess I at a loss, I moved to Sydney for a girl, as you do out of high school. I fell deep in love and then upended it. And I fell into hotel. I went to hotel school and then just fell into cooking. A chef approached me out front of Fraser and Hughes one morning when I was waiting to buy my textbook, and I needed a job and started as a kitchen hand and just, really fell in love with it from there.
Those early days, what were the real key moments in restaurants that sort of helped that appetite for working in the industry?
Growing up in Queensland and stuff, it was like we were pretty, a really working class family. It wasn't very much. It was, meat and three veg, that sort of thing. So that humble introduction to food really created a hunger and a passion for knowledge and learning about all these things. And I guess the pivotal thing was when, I was working with Frankie and he taught me how to make gnocchi for the first time. And it was just to see someone do something like that with a potato, and I'd never eaten gnocchi before. Like, I think, a fancy meal for me growing up was, when Mum would bake bolognese and penne in the oven, probably crack a barrel on top. My mind was a little bit blown when this guy was making bolognese and cooking it for 12 hours and then making these potato things with flour and potato that, I'd never really seen before.
You ended up in the kitchen of Cruz and Pendolino before moving to Melbourne to work at Bistro Guillaume. What was that period of time like?
I guess it was probably me being a little bit of a rat bag. I was Well, I was a young kid that was away from home, sort of left to my own devices, trying to figure out the world, and then throwing the melting pot of being a chef and, you know, work hard, play hard. I think I definitely burnt the candle at both ends for a long period of time. While, you know, I often say that I really threw myself into cooking just because I, you know, it was something that I was good at, and I just had to be the best that I could be, because that was my way of, you know, changing the mold and making something of myself. So I think I probably in hindsight went a little bit too hard in doing that. And the repercussions of being away from home without your support network, if you have a bad day, those bad days when you've got all your eggs in one basket, they're pretty terrible. You know, that leads to going out for a beer with the boys, which often would lead to 3 o'clock in the morning, and then that didn't make for a great day the next day. In hindsight now, it just compounded. So those are pretty, you know, pretty influential, but I was definitely finding my way.
You ended up working at Church Street and Ateca before moving to London, and there was big changes in your life in the UK. What was it like over there compared to the kitchens of Australia?
Well, I probably sillyly thought that I had a good grasp on things. You know, I was able to move through the kitchens quite quickly here and pick up things. And then, yeah, I got over there and it was just a different world. You know, the biggest thing was probably the amount that you work over there. You know, the hours are pretty big compared to what I'd done before, I mean, for a solid day. And then just the hierarchy of things, you know, yeah, it was a lot more like a military style operation. There was definitely no opportunity for conversation with things. It was sort of just do what I say and get on with it. But I mean, I attribute those 6 months in London, it's probably the toughest 6 months of my life, but probably that have given my career and my abilities probably the most. But yeah, they also took away a little bit of that passion and made me sort of start resenting cooking, which is why I probably why I only did 6 months in London and then went traveling.
Tell us about that time when you were traveling. What made you resent cooking? What was going through your mind at that time?
I mean, there was a lot going on back home. My pop was sick, and then I just felt like I wasn't good enough. And then just the mentality of, you know, there'd be people stealing your prep, they'd sit you up. Just wasn't a very nice environment at the time. And then, yeah, that sort of like, you know, the yelling and stuff. And like, I'm not one to say that you need to be babied, but it was definitely on another level. And it was just sort of that mentality that you take someone apart to put them back together. But I feel like it wasn't very often that those pieces were put back together. So you're sort of just getting dismantled, and yeah, just never really felt achievable. So it was just that thing. I thought, well, okay, if I'm really not enjoying this, this is something that I love, then I need to change my environment, and I need to find something that's going to give me, you know, if I'm spending 16 hours a day in a kitchen, you know, I don't want to be going home and feeling like shit about myself when, you know, there's definitely jobs in the past where I've had those tough days. And then, you know,
how did traveling through Europe inspire you in those days?
I guess it just gave me like a look at the, you know, the food landscape, because I had a lot of experience in Italian food, and then I just started learning about French cookery, and so I had that sort of European feel, but just actually going to these small European cities, and you know, I just remember going to Florence and you know, eating the bistecca alla Florentina, and just really that resonating with me, like after I'd just been out at one of the farms to see the cows, that just sort of seeing that connection and actually experiencing something that, you know, I'd seen on a menu in Australia and cooked 1,000 times over, but to actually be sitting there tucking into a 1.2 kilo big T-bone. Definitely sworn that he'd cook medium rare, but was probably only just put on the grill. That sort of thing was, really, really great to see, you know, and then just going around. Just the whole, you know, the romance of those beautiful old cities, it's just, I don't think anything can beat it.
When you came back to Australia, you spent some time at some pretty incredible restaurants and amazing chefs. What have been the real pivotal important moments and restaurants in your career?
I feel like being part of IDES during the pop-up phase was really was a really amazing part for my career. We did a lot of really cool events, and then the fact of what we achieved. You know, Pete's got this amazing thought process where he's, you know, as a chef, he really, really thinks about the experience from the second that, you know, someone books, not just when they're walking through the door. So just being a part of that and sort of seeing his thought process, as well as his style with cooking is so considered, and a lot of layering of flavor. So you sort of have this thing on the plate. It looks quite simple, but if you actually think back to the ways he started it and thought about it and the different layers, textures, and how considered it is, it really blew my mind to see that. My time with him, and then the other one would probably be Peter Gilmore. Two PGs. Pete's amazing, just his whole philosophy and the amount of work that he's put into reviving all these varieties of things, just that way, you know, we're all benefiting now. But just the fact that he had the foresight to try and do that, so he, you know, had these things to play with it at his disposal. And then just the whole natural approach, nothing really ever seems forced. It is, yeah. I could probably, yeah, I would, I've definitely been back to the kitchens a few times since I finished up to spend a bit of time just to see, you know, what was different and what's going on, because it's just one of those places that I think you can always gravitate back to, because it's always going to be something there that you can learn.
Peter Gunn's IDES started as a pop-up and has become one of Australia's best restaurants. And as you mentioned, you were there in the early days with the pop-up, and you eventually started pop-ups, and it's been a key feature of your career since then. Tell us about the decision to move into that sort of realm.
I guess off the back of doing Food for Thought for a couple of years, I think by that stage. And then obviously, you know, having experience and help Pete with all of those, eventually it sort of became the time that I met my wife at the time. So she was a sommelier at Tonka. On the weekends we would sort of challenge each other, and, you know, we might start with a bottle of wine and she would tell me all about it and what the things were that went with it. And then I would, you know, do a market run and we'd go through the markets and start build a dish or a menu. We'd just spend Sunday cooking and drinking a bottle of wine or three. And then we sort of invited a few people around, And, you know, they were like, oh, this is really good. Like, you guys should, you know, why aren't you doing this? So then that sort of off the back of that, that's where that started. And I mean, now we did 9 months in Europe, but we did a wine bar in Fremantle for 3 months randomly. This is like the original Fremantle bakery. So it's like 120-year-old bakery space with this beautiful courtyard. So we shipped everything over there. Like 10 boxes of handmade plates. The confidence to do it myself. Pete saw it probably about 6 months before I did.
Wow.
Yeah. And this is the thing. So, I think we had the conversation whether or not when IDES was going to go full time, whether or not I'd be a part of it or whether or not, I'd just continue doing my own thing, which is probably the hardest thing I've had to do. Just being, I think, honest with myself about, cause I'd always said that I'd be there for that. And then the realization that I wanted to feed this fire to do my own food. I think that freedom was really amplified when I got to France, because I think you get trapped in this bubble of like being worried about what's going on Instagram. You know, you're scrolling, you're looking what other people are doing, you're worried about the chefs are, they're sometimes a catty bunch of characters. So they think nothing's really new in the game. It's just different variations of it. So there's definitely chefs that like to sit there and be like, oh, he's doing that, he copied that off that person. So I think in France, like, that was the first opportunity that I had to really do my own thing and not worry about it. That noise out, because I just sort of, no one knew who I was, so no one knew anyone really, so I just sort of had this complete autonomy, which was really great, because I just sort of, not that I didn't give a shit, but I wasn't looking over my shoulder or anything. I didn't really care until one afternoon when Pierre Garnier walked in, but that was another story.
Well, tell us about that, one of the world's greatest chefs.
We got to Arles and it was about 2 weeks in, and when we landed, we found out that there was a feria, so a big bullfight, and they're like, well, your restaurant's going to be full pretty much every service. So we decided we'd do a set menu so we could maximize spend, because they said people would just sit and nurse a glass of wine. So I decided it was a smart idea to do a 5-course menu. That way we could get the spend up. But never mind that you're doing like 50 covers a service and you've got to prep that with two chefs and, you know, you're prepping. All of that was just a nightmare. And then the ducks and stuff over there, like getting whole ducks with heads on and dirty feet and all that sort of stuff. That was sort of the week that set up for me, like prepping 100 ducks by myself, start to finish, all that sort of stuff. And then the last day, the last service, I sort of had run out of a lot of like just the final touches, the nicer things. So I go for a run and do a little forage. And then when I got back, the girl's like, okay, we don't want you to freak out, but Pierre Garnier's booked in. And I was like, oh, okay, yeah, no worries, guys. All right, I'm just going to go set up for service now. No. Like, you need to be serious. Like we're being serious. And I was just like, what do you mean Pierre Garnier's booked in? Like, are you kidding me? I was like, why didn't someone tell me? And they're like, well, you were running. Like, did you think that we could get a hold of you? I was like, oh, God. So here I am freaking out that this guy's coming in. So I've knocked up this dish that I was testing. And then I go to like serve it to him, and then his wife is vegetarian, so it was this open duck ravioli. So I've done it, and then all of a sudden I've had to pivot and make an asparagus one for his wife. So, but yeah, that was a really great experience trying to, you know, he came in and said thank you, and it was this awkward thing where I was like, I should try and get a photo with him because this will never happen again. And then I was embarrassed and, you know, sort of like don't want to feel like a dickhead asking someone in broken English, broken French for a photo. But yeah, just the fact that, you know, he really liked everything. It was probably one of the best things that's ever happened in my life.
All the while through your career, you had personal experience with mental health, and it led you to the creation of Food for Thought. Tell us a bit about starting that up and what it was for.
Yeah, well, as I sort of touched on it before, I think without knowing over the course of my career, I definitely probably went a bit all in on things. And then over time, that sort of, I guess that grinds away your resilience a little bit. But yeah, Food for Thought was just sort of, I hit probably a really bad point. That's happened a couple of times, I guess. And it's where I just sort of, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, I guess, in terms of, you know, not being content in the facets of my life. And, you know, those hard days when they're not good and that's all that you've got, very easy for your mind to tell you things. And then, you know, obviously it's your own mind that's telling you these things. And, you know, it's so easy that to have that that realization that suicide is a good idea. And yeah, I probably contemplated it for about 4 hours one morning. An especially hard week, and probably a very big night on the source. And I guess reaching out for help that morning, I was very lucky that my best friend answered the phone call. But that, I guess, started me on a path to actually being able to ask for help and being able to speak about what I was going through. And then in turn, the more I spoke about it, obviously you start to become more comfortable. But the other thing that I started to see was the help that was available. It was like we're lifted a little bit away from my face. So I started to see the bigger picture. And then, you know, talking to people, they're like, well, we never knew like that you were struggling. It just seemed like you were all over it. So then all of these things sort of started hitting me. And then, you know, I said to Pete, like, I really want to do something to make noise around this, because, you know, like Peter Gunn was probably massively pivotal in the decision to do Food for Thought and really supported me through it, kept me realistic about what to expect, because he sort of wanted me to not be back to where I started, because I got this instant like overriding excitement and hope that I could create this big movement that would help everyone, which in the early days was sort of there, but it was very hard to get any sort of traction, because at that time it was very much taboo to talk about mental health. So it was very hard to get anything in the papers. So it was hard to advertise the events. Initially it was probably too big of a risk for restaurants to affiliate themselves with something like that. So we sort of did the first one, and we were chefs in the best restaurants in Melbourne. I couldn't tell you how many hats we had, you know, but it had to be off the back of our own names, and it was just a lot of families and friends, and we probably only sold about 75% of the tickets. So yeah, Pete keeping me honest with that one and saying, you know, I don't want you to get your hopes up, because, you know, people might not necessarily care about the fact that you're trying to do this. And I think probably saved me from going down into depression again. Cause I mean, that first one, I only got through it with a glass of full Prosecco pretty much the whole time. because it was still very fresh for me. And I was, I mean, I can speak about it quite plainly now, but that first one was really, really difficult. But then it built. I mean, we only really had maybe one major publication write about it in the first 3 years. And that was, I think, maybe the third year. And then it was very hard to get. Yeah, I mean, probably the biggest year was the fifth year. By that stage, I sort of, it had blown up to be too big for me. And I started doing doing the opposite. So initially it empowered me to give mental health a face, something that I could fight. And then towards the end, it was just, it was, yeah, it did the opposite. It sort of, I think it was probably about 3 months too late. I'd already had like commitments, you know, still 3 months into the future, and I was back struggling. Yeah, just sort of, unfortunately, it was right at the time where it was getting a lot of press. But I mean, off the back of that, there's a lot of people in the mental health space now that are doing things. So I guess it's a positive to know that there's plenty of people still talking about it, even though right now I'm still building myself up to be able.
What impact did this initiative that you created have on people through these events?
I think, like, there was, you know, having all the chefs that we had involved, you know, it really empowered them. And, you know, the tools that we sort of talked about at the events, because it was more than just the dinners. I did a lot of, and then a lot of, you know, I was lucky enough to be invited on the Electrolux produce tour with 1 year of the finalists, and the finalists for that year, like just being able to talk to them and sort of give them tools and help them identify things that might help them, you know, help other people. It's probably one of the best things that I was able to achieve, but just, I think, the availability to be able to tell people, you know, that it's it's okay to not be, and then to sort of, I think when you give people tangible examples of, you know, how to spot a behavioral change, or even just opening people's eyes up to the fact that, you know, we go through our lives as chefs and we become good chefs, and then all of a sudden we're a manager. We're trained for 4 years or 3 years to be a chef, and then all of a sudden we're a manager, and there's not really any training to that. So we're chefs looking after people, and then these people are the apprentices like myself that, you know, they're not at home, they're away from their family, they could be figuring out how to, you know, be an adult, and then you're throwing them into this pressure cooker where they're not used to, there's heat, there's sharp objects, there's this pressure to get things perfect every time. I mean, and I hope that in this day and age, there's not like the military style kitchens and the yelling, but I mean, it is a hot place and people do get angry on the odd occasion, but you know, I feel like there's this disconnect, and it's just being able to tell people, like, take a step back and, you know, are you explaining yourself properly? Do you remember what it's like to be an apprentice? I think because a lot of people forget.
What's some of the things you identified through your own experience that helped you create the tools to share with people?
I think it's just like sharing my story has been the biggest one, like the biggest tool that I've been able to share with everyone. I mean, I did a bit of training with Are You Okay about like their steps on how to have a conversation with someone, and sort of a bit of the backstory about how to, you know, if you see a behavioral change, maybe, you know, someone's appearance, or like they look like they've had a few rough nights, or maybe they're heavily distracted at work and they're cutting themselves or they're burning themselves, maybe there's something more to that. And then that might be a point at which you just check in with them. But I guess the biggest thing is probably, you know, you need to have a pre-existing relationship, especially with your staff, to be able to have the ability to have a conversation. So I think one thing that I really pride myself on is when I position, and it doesn't even have to be, I don't even have to be a head chef, but if I'm in sort of like a senior role, or just if I'm a senior person in a kitchen, I'll really make an effort to make sure that I will say hello to everyone, you know, while looking them in the eye, ask them how they are, if they're coming back from a weekend, ask them how their weekend was. But then along, I used to make everyone coffees every morning and go around, and that's, you know, 20 coffees. Also a barista. But just that, you know, that fact that you've made that effort to go and say hello to everyone and you're checking in with them. And then in turn, like a lot of people would come to me if there was an issue because they thought that there was this pre-existing relationship that I could help. You have, in some venues, you have people and like they don't even, you know, they walk in and they're so focused on the things that they need to do that there's this disconnect until it's time to, you know, have you got this? Have you got that? You know, and I think that's one really big thing because if you do notice that person that's cut themselves three times today, and you know, you pull them aside and you're like, you know, what's going on? Are you okay? I've noticed you've cut yourself a few times. Is everything all right? Do you need a little bit of support? That person is probably not really that likely to open up to you if there is something going on. If, you know, you've walked to them and the first thing you've said is like, you know, have you got enough quail for today? So I think, and, you know, it's very easy to slip into these patterns and it's because we're, you know, we're so rushed off our feet as chefs. We're worried about, you know, food costs, getting things done. Obviously there's all the pivoting with COVID, not knowing what the next day would bring, but you don't have that sort of connection with your staff. I think that can make it really hard for you as a manager.
You're now back surrounded by family and friends and you've started a young family of your own. How important has that been for your own mental health?
It's just amazing. I think, I mean, you would know how refreshing it is to have like the laughter in your house. What Sonny's smile does and his like little laugh. I mean, no matter how tired I am, it takes when he wakes up from his nap after he's woken me up from my nap. You know, he pushes himself up and just sort of smiles because he sees you and you know, it doesn't matter how tired you are, that just sort of washes everything away. But I think it's really helped me not bring work home. I'm able to disconnect because I get home and I try and do these things, but then I just sort of, I feel like I'm robbing him of time. So I guess it means I'm forcing myself to find that balance, and I'm not really wanting to take any time away from him and from my wife as well, because I mean it's hard to try and figure out what this baby human is that can't speak to you, that can only screaming or laughter, what they need. I mean, initially it's, you know, it's like change hungry or you know, upset, and you've got to go through the motions to figure out which one it is. So I think just trying to be supportive of that, like, and sometimes it's hard, but you know, it's not that hard in the scheme of things.
I know you're involved in quite a few things at the moment, but what's on the card? What are you building towards at the moment with your career?
I've sort of I guess I'm going away from cooking a little bit. Well, I am and I'm not. it's a bit of a weird one. I guess, like, I'm sort of changing my idea of what I look like as a chef or as a hospitality professional. That's probably a better blanket statement. I'm back baking now. So that's sort of been a little bit of a shift in the last couple of weeks to working overnight, which is it's a lot of a different stress to like a server stress. Dealing with 400 or 500 kilos of sourdough a night's pretty physical, but also don't have to deal with the risk of burning or cutting myself. Sharpest knife I've got is a bench knife that I portion the dough with. So that's been really, really good to be sort of back baking and trying to learn skills, you know, that are different from cooking in a commercial bakery sense, like an artisan bakery sense. But then last Sunday we did our first pop-up event. So we had the Food Plus Wine pop-up for years. And that was quite a lot of work, and I've realized that sort of I don't have the availability to work that hard anymore. So me and Kate have teamed up with Tabitha, just that way we can sort of, you know, you can achieve a lot more comfortably with two chefs in the kitchen that have sort of got that mutual goal towards doing something together. So we've launched Any Given Sunday under the we've done like one event now, and we also did like a bake over for Lifeline a couple of weeks ago and raised I think like $3,500-$4,000. So that was a lot of bread, and we did some butter chicken sausage rolls and a bee sting and stuff. You know, just doing different things to sort of keep ourselves interested and also keep people interested in what we're doing. So we'll look at, you know, like a hospo night down the track and that sort of thing.
Well, it sounds amazing, Mal, and what you've achieved for everyone else in the industry is inspiring. Hats off to you for that. We've loved having you on Deep in the Weeds today to share your story, and look forward to seeing more of your pop-ups all around the country. Please keep in touch, and we'll catch up again soon.
Will do, mate. Thank you.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we share the stories of Australia's hospo community, suppliers and producers in search of hope during this pandemic. Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen. Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay safe and be well.